Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Greatest Games podcast on the Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. With me is Jonathan Wilson. And with us today, everybody, is Steve Tung, an author and former sports journalist, having covered 9 World Cups, no less. And back in the day, Steve founded Foul, regarded as the first football fanzine. Steve's latest publication, though, is a book called West Midlands Turf Wars, A History of Football in the West Midlands. Steve, pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you very much. Very good to be here.
Today we go back to May 1981 for the FA Cup final replay that ended Tottenham Hotspur 3, Manchester City 2. Steve, why have you chosen this game?
Well, two things really. It was a very exciting, very entertaining and quite feisty final, the replay at least, rather than the first game. Certainly one of the best of the era. And I think a bit of a turning point for both clubs, which we might come to later. As a minor historical point, it was also the 100th FA Cup final, which attracted a bit of attention at the time. And then there's the personal element, which I think has been the case for many people in this series, this excellent series, I meant to say. I was working on local radio in London, LBC, which had only come on air in 1973 as the first commercial station once independent local radio station started up. And football, fortunately, was regarded as a big part of the coverage and was well backed by the management. So by about 1981, I was going abroad with Arsenal and West Ham and Spurs and teams in Europe and so on. And we had a very lucky run in the FA Cup in particular, because Arsenal, if you remember, got to 3 successive finals, of which the third, of course, was a London derby against West Ham, which was very big for us. And I was seeing a lot of both of those teams in particular, Spurs especially. Got to know the manager, Keith Birkinshaw, is a lovely man, very well, and some of the players. And the great thing about local radio, of course, you're allowed to be a little bit biased. you don't want to be too biased to one particular club, because then you upset the supporters of all the other clubs. And I think we had 12, because we pretended Watford was in London, which, of course, it isn't really. But when it's a London team against someone from Manchester or Merseyside or wherever, you're allowed to hope that they win. And from a purely personal and selfish point of view, of course, it makes for a much better programme. If they do, especially in an occasion like the Cup final, we were doing full 90-minute commentary of both games, which was quite rare for us. And you always want to be interviewing winners rather than losers, I do, on a day like that. But I like the people at Spurs. So we gave it a very big build-up. Funny the things that stick in your mind. I can actually remember recording the trailer for it, which shamelessly quoted the famous couplet, "Aussies going to Wembley, his knees have gone all trembly."
Wonder when that was going to get a mention. Yeah.
That wonderful Dylan-esque lyric. number 5 in the charts, as you may or may not remember, Aussie's Dream, and stayed there for 5 or 6 weeks, apparently. So that was the build-up to the first game, which, of course, became a bit of an anticlimax.
Yeah. But we should say, by the way, that when you talk about being biased on local radio and so on, your first love is, of course, Leighton Orient. So maybe were you always quick to say, "Well, I'm actually a Leighton Orient fan," to try and appease some of the red side of North London, perhaps?
Yes, I think they knew that. Of course, we didn't get many 90-minute commentaries on Leighton Orient. the biggest game we did get, where I had to pretend not to be too biased, was the semi-final of 1978 when they played Arsenal at Stamford Bridge, which became another huge anti-climax as well, because Malcolm McDonald kept shooting and getting deflections off our players into the net, and it became a very one-sided semi-final indeed.
Yeah. Jonathan, yeah, this FA Cup final replay, was a great game. What are your thoughts immediately when someone thinks the 1981 FA Cup final?
Well, this is the last cup final I didn't watch. My first cup final was 82. But it is that weird thing that happens. And I wrote about this when Gert Müller died, that when you're a kid growing up, the stuff that happened immediately before your sort of footballing consciousness, that takes on this additional power. So for me, growing up in the early 80s, Gert Müller was always the greatest goal scorer, because he, you know, in the 80s, he was referred back to as, well, is Ian Rush as good as Gert Müller? And so you thought, oh, Gert Müller, he must have been great, because he's maybe better than Rush. And this final, or the replay rather, and obviously the Ricky Villa goal, which remains one of the most famous FA Cup final goals, one of the most famous goals at Wembley. was constantly referred back to as, well, this final was, it's not quite as good as 81, is it? So 87, I think, when Coventry beat Spurs, was the first cup final I remember watching that was referred back to as, yeah, maybe this is actually the best of a decade. Maybe this is better than 81. So yeah, this game, although I only watched it in highlights, was a huge part of my childhood and was sort of one of those touchstone games that you just knew what had happened even though you hadn't watched it live.
Mm. And Steve, you mentioned Keith Birkinshaw, the Spurs manager there. Obviously, you worked with quite a bit. One of the most decorated Spurs managers in history, actually. I think only the great Bill Nicholson maybe has won more trophies than him as Spurs manager. Quite an intriguing guy. Didn't have a spectacular playing career. I don't think anyone would argue with that too much. Hadn't done a huge amount before taking the Spurs job. Can you tell us a little bit about him? You know, what type of man he was and how he impacted the club when he took over?
Yes, easily forgotten that it wasn't his first FA Cup final. He was the coach of Newcastle in 1974 when Newcastle got very badly beaten by Liverpool, of course, 3-0. And one of the things he said going into 81 was that he thought that the Newcastle team completely froze on that day. It had been billed as a game in which they would give a very good Liverpool team a decent game because they had Malcolm McDonald around whom there was huge amounts of publicity, who did virtually nothing all game. And one of the things Birkinshaw was very keen on in 1981 was that they shouldn't just freeze as he felt his team had.
Or that their knees shouldn't go trembly, perhaps.
Indeed,
well.
That yes. Yeah. Great worry that Ozzy had gone all trembly.
Yeah.
He was brought down by Terry Neill when Terry Neill, rather surprisingly, a former great Arsenal man, of course, became ahead of George Graham doing the same thing, became a manager of Tottenham and was therefore never terribly popular, though in fact he did reasonably well as manager of Tottenham before doing what really he was always going to do and go back to Arsenal. He brought Keith down with him, and he was, in many ways, he was the slightly stereotypical Dewar Yorkshireman. But like a lot of those stereotypes, once you got to know him, he did have a decent sense of humour. The players liked him. He got on very well. He was very reasonable with the media. And we had, of course, much better access to managers and players in those days. He was always very good. The only thing I never quite got over to him was that he was obviously a fan of BBC Radio London rather than LBC, because virtually every time I went to see him on a Friday after training, he would say, "You're Tony Blackburn's station, aren't you?" Tony Blackburn at that time had left Radio 1, one of the culls of Radio 1, of the real older generation, had got a programme on Radio London, which he played with what he always claimed was his favourite soul music. And Keith obviously listened to this on the way into training. It was definitely on every Friday morning. And so in the end, I just would sort of nod and say yes, without really wanted to correct him and say that LBC was actually the news and sports station, which gave Spurs and all the other London clubs all this coverage. But he was a very good man. He did end up with a very good record, as you say, ending slightly sadly, really, in that, of course, his final match was 1984 and the UEFA Cup final, which they won on penalties, at which stage he already knew he was leaving because he'd just fallen out with the new regime, the Irving Scholar regime, who wanted to take Tottenham in a new, much more corporate direction. And his famous quote, of course, looking back at the ground, was that there used to be a football club there. So it was a sad finish in a way, and Peter Shreves took over from him. But I think it wasn't just me. I would say everybody among the media corps and the supporters who gave him a terrific farewell really liked him very much. He was a very nice guy.
Mm. Well, of course, the opposite, his opposite number, John Bond in the Man City dugout, West Ham legend, did later work for the BBC, rather than LBC as a commentator. But Jonathan, the Manchester City side, they had a core of local lads playing for them. They had Joe Corrigan, Nicky Reid, Paul Power, Dave Bennett, all from the sort of the Manchester area. What are your thoughts on where were Manchester City around this time? Because obviously younger listeners to this podcast will know them as this sort of superpower now that came out of a sort of the second best club in Manchester. Where were they in the 1980s?
I suppose for them it was sort of that slightly awkward phase where they had a genuinely great side late 60s. Obviously won the league in 68, immediately was overshadowed by United winning the European Cup. And clearly this side wasn't as good as that team. They won the League Cup in 76. So they were... I think they were always sort of one of those teams who didn't quite deliver on their potential. You could see they could be a huge team. They could be immensely successful. And they probably weren't quite as successful as they might have been. I mean, they just got Dennis Stewart back from New York Cosmos, where he'd gone in 77, as he will tell you within 5 minutes of meeting you, to be Pele's replacement.
That's and fair, he, I think.
I think he was the only change to either team for the replay, wasn't he? He became City substitute. I think that was the only change either side made. And he actually plays the last 11 minutes. I can't believe I'm talking about Dennis Stewart immediately. I've gone straight for the Sunderland bloke, who I know a bit. But he does actually make a bit of a difference that last 11 minutes when he comes on. But yeah, they're sort of in that sort of transitional period. But by the mid-80s, obviously, they're getting relegated under Billy McNeil.
But it was a remarkable season, in fact, the 80-81, because they started off with Malcolm Allison in charge, who one of those people who, for me and I think many others, was simply one of those who was a terrific coach. He was a wonderful coach, there's no doubt about that, but just couldn't cope with being a manager. And once he got involved with things like transfers, was a complete nightmare. And they failed to win any of the first 12 games of the season. And so sacked Allison, who, of course, had been such a great figure for them as coach under Joe Mercer in the championship season that Jonathan mentioned, brought in John Bond from Norwich. And when he lost his first game, they were bottom of the league and were seriously worried about relegation, even at that stage, because they were one of those clubs who always seemed to be teetering on the brink of some financial crisis or other. But John Bond got them on a terrific run. In fact, one of his very first games, they beat Spurs 3-1, which was a little pointer towards the final when the time came around. And he got them up to finish 12th, I think, in the end, which was only a couple of places behind Spurs. So they did appear at that stage to be a team on the up. And after the final, it went on and signed Trevor Francis. But from then on, as we might discuss later, it came downhill. But it was a time when they seemed to be on the up. And the first thing he did was to sign two players who would be very influential in the final, who were Tommy Hutchison and Jerry Gow, who play a very combative role in getting amongst the Spurs players, Hoddle and Ardiles. What I was going to say about the background to the final was that from Spurs' point of view, I think you really have to go back to the summer of 78 and the signing of the two Argentinians, which for those who weren't around at the time, you can probably still imagine what a sensation it was, because there weren't very many foreign players around at all at that stage. Argentina had won the World Cup. Ardiles had played every game and been one of their most influential players. Ricky Villa had been on a bit more as a sub. And Jonathan will know all the background, I'm sure, of the clubs. But I imagine the impression over there was that some of the clubs who probably weren't in great financial position realised that this might be a time to capitalise and that they could get really good money for some of their better players.
Yeah, I mean, there'd been a ban on players going overseas in the build-up to the World Cup. The Hunter had stopped players going. So I think the only foreign registered player in that World Cup was Mario Kempes.
Kempes was at Valencia.
At Valencia, yeah, because he'd already been there and he was a big enough star that they weren't going to kick up a fuss about it. And that was why the fullback who went to Birmingham, Tarantini, that was why he technically didn't have a club during that tournament, because he was out of contract, but he wasn't able to sign for a foreign club. But sort of the deal was, if you win the World Cup, you can go and you can make your fortune. Because although the Hunter was in the late 70s beginning to stabilise the economy, which then falls apart in the early 80s, which is why they end up invading the Falklands, there was a sort of sense that they needed a foreign war to focus domestic minds. So they toyed with the idea of going to war with Chile over an island in the Beagle Channel. And actually, this has a huge impact on the 82 FA Cup, because if I get the sequence of events right, I think it's April the 2nd, Tottenham beat West Brom in the semi-final. On the 3rd, Ardiles goes back to Argentina. And I think Argentina play a friendly against the Soviet Union, which I don't think he's involved in. But he goes back to be involved in the build of the 82 World Cup. And then on the 4th, Argentina invades the Falklands. And on the 5th, Thatcher puts together the task force to go and try and reclaim them. So the story of Ardiles and Villa, I mean Villa stayed in England, whereas Ardiles didn't come back from Argentina for, I think, 18 months, because he went to play in Paris. And Villa ends up not playing in the 82 final because he was seen as too politically sensitive. So their story is completely bound up in the Falklands and Anglo-Argentinian relations. But yeah, the 78, A, you've just had the ban on foreign players lifted in England, and B, you've just had the ban on players leaving Argentina lifted. And there's this mass exodus as people are chasing, you know, quite understandably, chasing the cash away from a very turbulent country.
That was a fairly small club, Ardiles, from Huracan, I imagine.
From Huracan, yeah. I mean, Huracan had a very... They'd won the league in, I want to say, 74. But I think that was the only title they'd ever won. Incredibly attacking side. René Ousmane was in that team as well. And that was under Menotti. That's the only trophy Menotti's won, apart from the World Cup, remarkably.
But Ozzy had made it clear that he wanted to move abroad and was very, very much thinking of Spain, Italy, France. I don't think the idea of England had occurred to him. So there were two surprising phone calls. First of all, Keith Berkinshaw sitting in his office at Tottenham when the phone rang, and it was Harry Haslam, the Sheffield United manager, who had very good contacts in Argentina because of his coach, Oscar Arce.
And had very nearly signed Maradona.
Yes, yeah. Decided he couldn't afford anyone like Ardiles, but his question for Keith Berkinshaw, a very surprised Keith Berkinshaw, was, do you want to sign Ozzy Ardiles? Tottenham's background was that they had just been promoted from the second division, having been rather surprisingly relegated the year before, and had only just scraped back into the top division on goal difference in third place. And these days they would have been in the playoffs. But they did need strengthening. In fact, for my mind, what they needed was a centre forward. But Berkinshaw is asked, do you want to sign Ozzy Ardiles? He's also told that Arsenal might be interested, which worried him a bit, that Arsenal drop out. And meanwhile, he says, yes, he'll go over there and meet this little lad. And Ozzy Ardiles, equally surprised to get a phone call saying the manager of Tottenham wants to meet you. I imagine he knew a bit about Spurs, but it certainly wasn't what he was thinking about coming to England at all. But he got on very well with the meeting, just him and Keith Berkinshaw, no agents or anything involved. And I think it was probably Berkinshaw who suggested that it would be a good idea if somebody else came over with him. And Ricky Villa had been his roommate throughout the 78 World Cup, and they were big pals. And so he was suggested, and Berkinshaw went back to the Spurs chairman and said, can we sign two of them? And again, slightly to the surprise, because Spurs weren't known as a big spending club at that point, they'd always been regarded as a bit parsimonious by their players in particular. And surprisingly, he got the go-ahead. So from a team which for my money, needed above all a centre-forward, they'd actually bought two midfield players. And the thing that is very easily forgotten is that for two seasons, things didn't actually go terribly well at all. They had a terrific start. The first fixture of the season, which was fantastic, they'd drawn away to Nottingham Forest, the champions. So you have the champions against the team with these two new Argentinians and the most sensational transfer of the summer. Capacity crowd at the City Ground, and they get a one-all draw. And not only that, but Villa scores the Spurs goal. So it all looks hunky-dory, except that by Christmas, the first home game, they lost 4-1 to Aston Villa. At the start of September, they went to Anfield and lost 7-0 to Liverpool. They then came back the week after that in the League Cup and played at home to Swansea, who are in the third division, And with Tommy Smith clattering into Ardiles and everybody else, Swansea beat them 3-1. And this, in the days, remember, when teams didn't just make 9 or 10 changes for the League Cup, they put out their first team because they wanted to win it. So they've lost 7-0 to Villa, lost 2 home games. And even before Christmas, when things weren't really improving at all, they play Arsenal in the Argentinians' first North London derby. And they're told naturally by all the English lads, this is the one we've really got to win. And Arsenal win 5-0 at White Hart Lane. So it's not going terribly well, really. Spurs finish 11th. In the second season, they're 14th. They're in the bottom half of the table. Glenn Hoddle, who really come on and matured as a player, is the leading scorer. In fact, he's the only one who looks likely to score. And they still haven't signed any strikers. When they'd gone up, the main striker was John Duncan, who, a Scottish lad who was terribly injury prone. And in fact, within a couple of games of that season, they sold him.
So, and that's for John Duncan, who goes on to manage Chesterfield.
Yes, yes.
When they get to the Cup semi-final.
Yeah, another very nice man who did amazingly well at Chesterfield. So summer of 1980, going into the season we're going to talk about, they finally pushed the boat out and signed not one but two strikers. Steve Archibald for £800,000 from Aberdeen, which I think at the time was the biggest fee between the Scottish and English club. And then, perhaps even more surprisingly, because he looked exactly like the sort of player they wanted, very quick, very sharp centre-forward, Garth Crooks comes from Stoke for about £600,000. So this rather parsimonious Spurs board have suddenly spent £1.5 million on two strikers. And they do look, at least they begin to look like a different team, and yet still in the league only 10th in the whole of that season, a season in which Crooks and Archibald between them get nearly 50 goals. And it was obvious what the problems were because they scored nearly as many goals as the champions, who were Aston Villa, but they conceded more than one of the relegated teams. So,
but I mean, you look at that midfield, and you think, you know, from right to left, Villa, Ardiles, Hoddle, Galvin, Tony Galvin on the left. I'm not seeing many tackles in that midfield.
No.
And I know Ardiles by 87 was playing as a sort of deep lying playmaker with Hodge and Paul Allen either side, you know, sort of scuffling around. But there isn't a lot of scuffle in that team.
No, that's no. Exactly the problem. I happened to have spoken to a couple of those older Spurs players quite recently for interviews, and Paul Miller, who's centre-half in the Cup final, said what we missed and what we lacked was a defensive midfield player. The irony of which, of course, was that they had one called Graham Souness, who turned out not to be a bad player, and let him go because he was so frustrated that he was in the reserves and couldn't get in the first team. And I think Bill Nicholson basically just got a bit fed up for him, and when he got a phone call from Middlesbrough asking if they could take him, he said, off you go. So that was what they missed. The thing, Terry Naylor, who missed out, he had literally just left before this 1980 season, missed out on all the excitement. He said to me, the trouble was we had Ozzy and Ricky and Glenn in midfield, but we only had one ball. And even when we had the ball, only one of them could have it. And the implication, of course, also was that when Spurs didn't have the ball, when the opposition had it, either, as Jonathan says, they weren't going to win many tackles, or those three weren't going to be seen, even when Ozzy was dropping a bit deeper as well. So it was clear what the problem was. Of course, it was wonderfully exciting to watch. I mean, I was lucky enough at that stage, I could virtually choose which London game I went to each week, and it was very tempting every week Spurs were at home to say, yes, so White Hart Lane would do me, because there was some terrific entertainment there. But that was the problem with the side, and really, we'll see how much of a problem it was in the actual final as well.
Absolutely. All right, let's have a quick break, everybody, and then after that, we'll talk about the final itself. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Greatest Games on the Blizzard. So yes, gentlemen, to the match, the 100th FA Cup final. It was 10th Spurs versus 12th Manchester City, and it went to a replay, of course, which is the game we're focusing on. But the first game, Jonathan, finished 1-1 with Tommy Hutchison scoring at both ends. He scores a lovely header for Manchester City, and then a terrible own goal, which is also quite comical, really.
Yeah, I mean, his header's a great goal. It's, you know, Ray Ranson crossed him right. I think a modern team would wonder quite how the fullback had been given so much space, but you know, you've still got to put the cross and you've still got to score it. And John Motson has a very strange bit of commentary where he goes, and the oldest man on the pitch has... Well, is it that surprising the oldest man on the pitch should score? But anyway, he does.
And then, I think he was 33, was he? He wasn't that old.
Yeah, I mean, I know people aged quicker in those days, but still, yes, quite. But even if he'd been 40...
Yeah, true.
Why is it surprising he scored? It'd be surprising if he ran like 80 yards and scored. But to put a header in the top corner, much of your age really matters. Anyway, it was a free kick, 10 minutes to go? Mm. And I think what happens is there's a Spurs player makes a run to down the blind side of the wall. And I think Hutchison goes across to try and cover that. And then when Hoddle, the free kick, there's sort of two touches before Hoddle strikes it. And so he's had time to sort of make that run off the wall to try and check the run. And so he's in that sort of hole position just outside the right-hand post. And the ball, you know, clips him and loops into the far corner. So it looks terrible. But I think he's actually a bit unlucky because his fault, if it's a fault, is to be the one who's alert to that blind side run.
It's a type of goal that you don't see very often at all. It just looks a bit strange. Yeah. When I say comical, he's done something ridiculously stupid, of course. No, but the game finished... Oh, sorry, Steve.
Sorry, Jack Charlton on I think it was the ITV commentary, did actually blame him. He said what he was doing there. Just one quick story about that free kick. Steve Perryman, whose autobiography, if anyone ever comes across it, is, for my money, one of the very best of that era, very intelligent lad. One of his great complaints about Ozzie in particular, and he loved him, and all the Spurs players loved him, but he described how on a Friday morning, like a lot of teams, they would do some set pieces to finish their training session, and they would spend half an hour or 40 minutes working on things exactly like that, free kick just outside the penalty area, and they'd do it and do it and do it and do it until they got it off pat. And then the next, the Saturday afternoon, the next day, when they got a free kick in exactly that position that Glenn Hoddle was supposed to do something clever with, Ozzie Ardiles would grab the ball and think he'd seen a clever pass and play a clever pass and drive everybody mad, including the manager, because he was an off-the-cuff player in so many ways. And Steve Perryman's big thing, and one of the reasons which he felt they weren't as successful as they should have been in these earlier years, was they just weren't organised enough. His big thing was organisation. Ozzie's big thing was playing off the cuff, and the manager was really caught somewhere in between the two. But yeah, I was going to say, Jack Charlton actually did blame Tommy Hutchison for that on one of the commentaries. He basically said, what is he doing there? And Jonathan's right that he thought somebody was going to go down that side. But when you look at it, he's a very long way back. And it does look as though Joe Corrigan would have comfortably, it was a decent hit by Glenn Hoddle, but it did look as though Joe Corrigan would comfortably have saved it. So Tommy Hutchison, I think, became the first player since, and probably only the second one ever since 1946, to score at both ends in a cup final. You had to give it as an own goal. It very definitely was. And he becomes... One of the personality players of that final for all the newspapers and so on. The other one, of course, is Ricky Villa, who frankly had a terrible game. Brian Moore in the ITV, the cup final in those days, that younger people may not know, was always shown on both channels, BBC and ITV. And Brian Moore, the great ITV commentator, picked up very early on that he said Ricky Villa is just having no impression on this game. And he was taken off in the second half, 65, 66 minutes. And there's this wonderful image of him. He walks all the way from the bench, walks all the way round to the tunnel end, to the dressing room, all on his own, looking extremely miserable. And Ozzie said later that he was very, Villa was actually very angry. But it really, he didn't have much of a case because he had been playing very poorly.
Do you think in seeing that walk, the thing it reminded me of was Rettin having been sent off in 66? Do you think there was a self-conscious replication of that? I know that the tunnel was in a different place in 66, so he's walking kind of to a different corner. Mm. But that sort of Argentinian's long, slow trudge off a Wembley pitch seemed very familiar.
It was a great image. And Birkinshaw then, of course, had to make a big decision about whether to pick him for the replay. Gary Brooke, who was a young Spurs lad, sort of slightly chunky, not most skillful, but a more dynamic player in a way, had come on a substitute, and Birkinshaw had to decide whether to give him a game or pick Ricky Villa, and he decided to go with Villa.
Yeah, well, they were supposed to run changed, of course.
Yes,
in that replay. It's funny because Villa said, years later, he said, you know, he knew he was poor in that first match. And he said, I tried to explain this to English people or my teammates, that there was no in-between with me. I either played well or I was poor. And that game, I was poor. But it was almost as if it was a normal situation for me. I wasn't very consistent. You don't often hear footballers saying something like that, do you, Jonathan? Oh, the trouble with me is it was always hot or cold.
Yeah, but I guess there's an honesty to it.
Yeah, completely.
But also, it's quite a good way of sort of... Yeah, abnegating responsibility. You just go, you know, I'm never going to be 7 out of 10. 9 or 4, you know.
Yeah, you can't blame me for this. But he did start, of course, Steve, and it would become his final. And in that final, we only had to wait 8 minutes for the first goal, and it was Ricky himself who scored.
Yes, a great moment for him. Because, of course, if anything had gone wrong for him early on, I mean, Ozzy Ardiles in one of his autobiographies asked the question, what would have happened if Villa had missed that goal? Because it was a very straightforward goal. Ardiles had started it. He'd beaten three men beautifully out on the touchline, and Steve Archibald had his shot blocked. And it came back off the goalkeeper for a chance, which it would have been. And Villa must score, to quote another famous bit of FA Cup final commentary. But if for any reason he had missed it, you can imagine what that would have done to his confidence. But instead, you know, he's got redemption within 6-7 minutes of the start of the game. There was some doubt raised as to whether there might have been an offside decision, whether Archibald had been offside. It was difficult to tell from the replays that they had then. But fantastic start. And then, of course, within 2 minutes, an equaliser. With one of what Jimmy Hill at the time said, I think perhaps the best goal ever seen in a Wembley Cup final, which for about an hour it was.
I think it's better than Villa's goal.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree, actually.
I don't think it's as good as Jackie Milburn's goal in 55.
Oh, that's a beauty.
That was just a long shot, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a bit more than that. It's a turn and acceleration, a long shot.
Yeah. But Steve McKenzie's, it's a great forgotten goal, understandably. Obviously, they didn't win, and Villa scores it's a very different type of goal, of course. Maybe we see less goals like that. But McKenzie, yeah, you put it in that bracket of great forgotten goals. I mean, in the Euros that have just happened, you think of, you know, Benzema and Pogba's great goals against Switzerland. You know, they'll be forgotten because they lost the game. And I think this McKenzie one's one of those ones that a lot of people... I knew there was a couple of great goals in this game, and I needed to remind myself of it.
And Tommy Hutchinson, who set it up for him, of course, with the header.
A
bit of redemption for him as well. And he hits this magnificent volley. When I talked about Malcolm Allison earlier and transfers, I was a little bit unfair in Steve McKenzie, who was only 19 at the time of this game, was one of Allison's most famous transfers, and that he paid £250,000 for him before he'd ever played a league game for Crystal Palace. And everybody said, oh, this is Malcolm being mad as usual, because 250,000 in those days was a bit of a fee, and for someone who was probably 17, if not 18 at the time. But Malcolm thought he'd got this tremendous potential, and he was one of those who, unlike Steve Daly and 1.6 million and some of the others who Malcolm signed, did actually live up to it and hit this tremendous volley to equalise. So within 10 minutes of the final, we've got two goals.
And not long after that, you know, I mean, the game, yeah, you've already got two goals. It suddenly opens up, and it seems that it was sort of quite end to end fairly early on. Glenn Hoddle hits the post from a free kick on the highlights. And you said earlier, Steve, that they said that, you know, they needed more than one football with the players in that team. You saw Ozzie Ardiles' quality and snake hips, you know, in the build up to the first goal. See what Villa does, of course, in his second goal. You've got Hoddle in there as well. Did they all get on? I mean, did it work? Because when you have that much creativity and players like that who want the ball, were they competitive with each other, or did they understand where each one fitted into the free flowing, free scoring and free conceding system that they seem to have?
No, there was a lot of respect, and Ozzie was very obviously didn't know all that much about Glenn Hoddle when he first came here, because Glenn Hoddle was only just breaking into the England side, not all that much earlier. One or two of the Spurs players, Steve Perryman, I remember, actually thought Ricky Villa, when he first saw them in training and so on, he thought Villa was the better player because he had this tremendous close control. They thought he was just going to be a big, tough Argentinian, those who hadn't seen much of him in his sub-appearances in the World Cup. And they wondered how Ardiles would fare in the rough and tumble world of early 80s Football League play. So there was respect for each other. There was a little bit of disappointment for people. Like Spurs had one or two other very promising younger players, like Neil McNabb, who ironically ended up at Man City, very clever little midfield player. And he was the sort of guy who missed out because the two Argentinians had come in. So no, there was that respect between them. The other important thing I think about the second game was the lesson Spurs took from the first one was that they just had to be a bit physically tougher. I mean, they had people who could do that, Paul Miller and Graham Roberts at the back, and Perryman would always put his foot in. But even Ardiles said before the game, we've got to battle harder, we've got to do more running. And that was the lesson they took from it. And that was one of the reasons why it became quite such a feisty game. I lost count in the end, but I think there were at least five booked by Keith Hackett, wasn't it? And I think there'd been three or four in the first game anyway. So it got quite physical. But as you say, became wonderfully end-to-end, even in that first half. Villa almost got another goal. Hoddle hit the post. The City were becoming dangerous on the break. And it's at half-time at 1-1. It had already looked a very decent cup final.
Yeah, it was a great moment in that first half, Jonathan, which testifies to the game being end to end, and also people going a bit gung ho with the Spurs English-born Serbian father goalkeeper Milijar Aleksic, who comes flying out and punches the ball comfortably outside his own box.
Oh, way outside! A good 4 or 5 yards outside.
It's absolutely outrageous.
Goes over the top of Dave Bennett. And it's sort of just, I mean, now it's just a red card, the reddest of red cards, immediate. Nobody even think about it. And so then, was that outside the box? Oh, it is. Well, he's given a free kick. Mm. Oh, referee's showing leniency by not showing him a yellow card.
Yeah.
Is it? Come on. Like, you can't do that. Like,
it was pointed out that he had done the same thing in the league a bit earlier and had got booked. Whether referees have this thing about not remember, it's a long time before a player was sent off at a cup final, wasn't it? You always felt they were very reluctant to do that. Of course, by 1981, you actually had to kill somebody to get sent off football. And it had to be a pretty bad tackle to get your name taken.
You remember this better than me, but when did the professional foul law come in? Because that was sort of a response to Paul Allen being pulled down.
Yes,
the previous cup final.
Yes, 1980. Yeah, so that was in, and that was Kevin Moran, wasn't it, who then got to, that was United and Everton in 85.
Yeah.
He did get sent off. And I mean, everybody felt that Willie Young should have been sent off for that foul on Paul Allen. But
it's interesting that sort of the goalkeeper handling the ball is not seen as the same level of offence as pulling a player down. But actually, you know, if he'd stayed on his line, if he hadn't come flying out, Dave Bennett would have been in the box. Mm-hmm. If you assuming he controlled it, with a clear shot.
Yeah.
I mean, that is quite comical to look back on it nowadays. But as you say, Steve, one all at half time, nicely poised. And then on 50 minutes, Keith Hackett gives a penalty for a foul on Bennett. And bearing in mind everything we've just said there, I actually thought for a penalty in the early 80s, it was quite soft.
Yeah, I thought so. Or, of course, I was being very biased at this. probably told LBC listeners that there's an astonishing decision. He's actually given a penalty. It was certainly a nudge by Paul Miller. I mean, Bennett was breaking through into the area. Miller was almost level with him because he nudged him. And then, unfortunately, Chris Hughton came in from the other side. And you could imagine commentators these days would say they might feel it's a bit soft, or they would say, well, we've seen him given the other great cliche. But Keith Hackett gave it a certain not. Spurs didn't protest that much. If you look at the,
I think it's a pen.
Okay, all right.
I mean, it's not the Miller sort of, it's not the Miller arm. It's Hughton clips his heel.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And I from the position that I think it's one of those that probably very much depends on the angle you see it from, because it's for a TV viewer, it's the second angle they show from behind the goal where you see the clip on the heel very clearly, and given Hackett is sort of 10 yards behind on a slight angle, he probably had a very clear view of that. So I think it's a totally... And when I first saw it, because, you know, when you first see it, you don't realise Hughton's taken his heel. But as soon as you see that clip on the heel, I think it's just a pen.
Well, it was a far side for me, so that's why LB. Given the impression that it might have been very harsh. And I probably looked at my notes like John Motson and said, oh, the first cup final penalty for nearly 20 years, which is another remarkable statistic. And Kevin Reeves, who I think one of John Bond's old Norwich players, steps up to take it with a lot of pressure and takes a very good penalty.
Yeah, dispatches it in the corner.
I don't know if you notice, again, I assume this was delivered, but Aleksić is clearly standing off centre. Mm-hmm. So it's very obvious when you see the camera from behind the goal that he's wanting Reeves to go to the keeper's left, and he does, but because Alexis is off centre, he can't get anywhere near.
Thanks very much, mate. Appreciate that. Yeah, as you say, the game was a bit of a feisty one. It certainly gets heated from there, and there's Jerry Gow goes in very heavily on Ozzy Ardiles at one moment, and there's a bit of fisticuffs and so on, and it's even a fan runs on the pitch. And I mean, I'm guessing you mentioned earlier that the likes of Ardiles coming to English football with those sort of mazy dribbles and runs, he probably got quite a bit of treatment, I would imagine, when he was playing for Spurs, Steve.
Yeah, I think I think he was a bit surprised by his first meeting with Tommy Smith, and when Swansea, if you remember, had taken all these old Liverpool players down there and started their great run up the divisions. And yes, there would have been a few who were after him, and he probably didn't get the protection. But of course, I Jonathan will know, Argentinian football had its share.
True. Yeah, very true. Very true.
Never a booking in Argentinian football. Yeah. Never saw a foul. Very, very honest. Yeah, all about skill. Absolutely no cynicism in the Argentinian game in the 70s.
Yeah, I'm forgetting myself. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and he didn't. I don't recall that he ever complained too bitterly about it at all. He might have regarded Ricky Villa as a little bit of a minder for him, and certainly the others like Miller and Roberts would have looked out for anyone who they felt was treating him harshly. But as you say, I think Jerry Gow, there was on the BBC commentary, there was certainly a little lecture, rather pious lecture from Jimmy Hill about Jerry Gow's behaviour. The funny thing was, again, in comparison to the modern summarisers, I mean, you didn't hear from Jimmy Hill for about 10 minutes at a time. And then eventually John Motson would remember he was there and say a word from Jimmy Hill. And Jimmy, who was both, again, younger listeners probably just know him as a sort of TV presenter and pundit, but was a wonderful manager at his time, and the job he did for Coventry City, taking them from the third to the first division, and then very dramatically resigning on the almost the eve of their first division game because he wanted a 10-year contract. I mean, he could have been one of the outstanding managers of the time, and did great work off the field as well. So, Jerry Gow was stirring them up, but Spurs, as I say, had learnt the lesson that they had to be a bit tougher as well. And eventually got back into the game, although they must have been wondering if it was all going to go wrong with, what, about 20 minutes to play?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Steve mentioned earlier about the two signings that Spurs had made, Jonathan and Garth Crooks being one of them, and he gets the equaliser. But it's a lovely ball in from Glenn Hoddle that sets the goal.
Well, there's sort of... just before this is what looks a pretty obvious handball by Tommy Caton. It's not given. But then I think the ball doesn't even go out of play. It's sort of recycled. And Hoddle plays this... well, you know, Veer plays it in from the left to Hoddle. He chips this lovely ball over the top. And Archibald takes it down and probably would have recovered to get there, but doesn't need to because Crooks is backing up and slams it in to equalise.
Yeah, 2-2. And then it's, you know, it's nicely poised again. But
so just on Garth Crooks.
Yes.
Seeing this midfield, you do understand some of those Team of the Week selections for the BBC now.
Yeah, fair point, fair point. Anyway, we must go to the moment that really is the most memorable one of this cup final, Steve. 76 minutes in, that Ricky Villa goal.
Yeah, Tony Galvin actually starts it. Tony Galvin was a player who I always really liked, a very strong running, left-footed player who liked to hug that touchline. Almost certainly the only ever Republic of Ireland international who had a degree in Russian studies. Which, as he admitted, was never much use to him as a footballer because he didn't keep his Russian up. He was a very interesting bloke. He was very interested in politics. He was a very rare example of quite a left-wing footballer and quite a late developer because he'd done his university studies and come down quite, I think he was 20 or so before he actually signed a full-time professional contract. But he'd made that that left-sided position his own. He starts it with a very good run from his own half, whereas he was normally very good at going past the fullback on the outside. He actually comes back inside and plays it with his right foot into Ricky Villa, who's still got a lot of City defenders in front of him and suddenly starts off on this amazing run. I mean, once he gets into the penalty area, there are about four City players around him. And by the end of the move, I made it seven blue shirts in the penalty area. And he must have, he beats at least four of them. Two of them close in on him. And Joe Corrigan, of course, comes rushing out. And he'd made some, he had two very good games, Joe Corrigan, and made some brave saves. And Corrigan goes plunging down to try and dive at his feet, but finds that the ball is past him. And it was that, I think I mentioned close control earlier, that was one of, probably Ricky's greatest strength, especially for a big man. And that was one of the things that had surprised the Spurs players themselves. And suddenly we've got, you know, suddenly poor old Steve McKenzie's goal is completely forgotten. And yeah, that's that, but he's about to end up with a runners-up medal as well. Because of what was, I believe, later voted Wembley's goal of the century.
Yeah, goal of the century, Jonathan, eh? Against some stiff competition.
Not even goal of the match for me. So.
but it was a worthy winner, though, for most cup finals.
In context, I mean, because the odd thing about it is, when you watch it back, and obviously it would be very different if you were there in a moment seeing it live, but he basically runs forwards and then turns at right angles and runs right and then puts it in and no defender gets anywhere near him. Somehow this very kind of straight run is enough, but I mean, I guess that's where the space was. And yeah, but it's for close control. Steve's absolutely right that it makes it look perhaps less impressive than it is because it seems so natural and so easy.
But it's undoubtedly a great goal. And it wins Spurs the match, Steve. And you said earlier that this game, if I'm right in remembering, that the two clubs were at sort of at pivotal points, and Spurs would obviously go on and defend their FA Cup crown, and then would win a UEFA Cup, and that was it. Do you think this was a real sliding doors moment then for both teams?
Well, yes, particularly for Spurs, as you say, they retained the FA Cup. Again, with a replay, we suddenly get two replays in 2 years. But in that season, not only retain the FA Cup, they're the League Cup runners-up against a great Liverpool side. They actually take the league in the League Cup final. against Liverpool. They get to the semi-final of the Cup Winners' Cup. I remember going to Barcelona for the second leg of the semi-final, and they were just edged out by a single goal there. And they're fourth in the league as well. But in those days when, as I said, the teams took the League Cup very seriously, fixture congestion would frequently become a big problem. And so towards the end of the season, even if the League Cup is all played a little bit earlier, you've got a big interest in Europe, big run in the FA Cup with one or two replays as well, and this Cup Winners' Cup, which was very big to them. And they're still technically in the running, but they actually finished fourth 2 years running in the league. Keith Berkenshaw, as it so goes, and they win the UEFA Cup in 84. But from that moment of winning the FA Cup, they really are on the up. Even in all those years when the year doesn't end in one, they still manage to win some things. And even later in the decade, 85, 87, you know, they're third both times to Everton, Peter Shrews and David Pleat, and FA Cup runners-up in the 87 final, which you mentioned. And it's only when David Pleat had to leave because of a sort of personal scandal that it begins to fall apart a little bit for them. And City, being very City-ish, they are the club, remember, who just before the Second World War won the league championship and then got relegated the next season, which takes...
As top scorers as well.
Yes, top scorers. Does take some doing. City managed to get relegated within 2 years of this cup final, got up again, of course went down again, and it was really about 10 years, say 1991, before they managed to re-establish themselves in the first division at all after going through a whole crop of managers. So very much, oddly, a good start to that following season under John Bond. As I say, he signed Trevor Francis, who was still a very decent player. But that was one of those moves which just didn't work out in the end. And it was very much downhill for a long time for City.
Yeah. Well, when all said and done, it was a little golden period for Spurs, because this is not a slight on them at all. But, you know, factually speaking, they haven't won that many trophies. And to get a couple of FA Cups in that time and anyway, UEFA Cup was very good. Steve, it's been a pleasure talking to you about this cup final. Thank you very much for coming on the pod.
Thank you. It was great fun to relive it all, I must say.
For more stories like that, do check out theblizzard.co.uk, everybody. But thanks again to Steve, and myself and Jonathan will be back next week with another great game from the history of football. See you then.